good to see everyone this evening, and good to be studying this chapter of 1 Samuel. I found it very interesting and a fascinating study of Samuel's life. You know, sometimes we talk about young David and how zealous young David was for the Lord fighting against Goliath and so on, but Samuel certainly in this chapter shows himself to be pure and zealous for the Lord, and also an exciting character to study. All right, so question number one then.
Oh, let's, I did do a little background, I forgot. Here's the location of Shiloh, 19 miles north of Jerusalem, roughly. The name Shiloh is the same as Siloam and Shiloah, and Burton Kaufman has this commentary on it. Shiloh is a poetic name for the Messiah, the pool of Siloam in John 9, and all of these words basically are the same. I thought that was just an interesting note. Shiloh is, again, a word for the Messiah, and so this this place is literally named anointed, I suppose, or sent. I think the other, he comments on it that it can mean one sent. I kind of had this imagination of what this looked like in my mind's eye when I was thinking about what Shiloh would look like, because of course that's the tabernacle of Moses that we know that the people brought into the land. But actually there's an archaeological dig ongoing even this last summer in Israel, and here it is. You can see this dig. It's Shiloh's up on top of a mountain, and it's a large enough area that the whole congregation of Israel in Joshua 18 assembled there, and they set up the tabernacle. So hundreds of thousands of people can be on this mountainside. And notice the size of this development. This just gives you an idea of how large Shiloh was. It wasn't just the tent. It just wasn't a sparse tent. This was a community of people supporting the priests and the Levites. And here's one artist's, it may even have been larger than this, but there's the tabernacle, the tent of the tabernacle over there, and then here obviously is a little bit of a wall and some other tents. No one knows, of course, except for the people that are digging in the archaeological site. So when Samuel runs out of the tabernacle to find Eli, it's in supposedly in an adjoining tent nearby. To the tabernacle itself. Okay, so that brings us to question number one, which we decided that Logan had the last question, so this will be for Landon. Why was Samuel able to minister to the Lord as a child when there were age requirements for priests? How old was he? What are some of the implications about the word of the Lord, how it was delivered, and how it came to be described here, and what it meant that it was infrequent in those days?
Yeah, so to question A there, or simply not told, we've kind of touched on this last time. We study Samuel. Numbers 8 is where it gives the age restriction. It's verse. I think the age range is 25 to 50. Yeah, okay. Age 25 years old there, and to 50 at verse 25. So that's the current rules for priest work. And as to why Samuel was allowed to, you know, not follow those, we assume Josephus, this is getting into question B, Josephus says tradition says he's about 12 years old, and the word nar there, or nar that's used in chapter 17, is a word that describes teenagers, so he's about there, early adolescence, early teen. So why is he able to do this? The Lord can do what he wants. We're not told. Obviously Samuel was a special child. He was promised by his mother Hannah before he was born that he was to be dedicated to the Lord all his life. So obviously this is a special case, and the Lord thought it was right that he was an exception to this rule. Question C, what are some of the implications? Well, what implications about how the word of the Lord was delivered and how often it came up? It's said that it wasn't very often, and we know that Israel's currently going through a time of great sin. You know, Eli's sons, Ophni and Phinehas, are doing terrible things at the temple, fornicating, and many other sins. And I'm sure that's kind of the standard that's going on. I'm sure it's not just those. I'm sure most of the priests are also committing those things. We talked about how the sin of fornication and worship is kind of a cultist thing. You know, the pagans all do that. So maybe it's probably been like adopted by the Israelites. They kind of worked it into their own worship service. And so we talked about how it's kind of the era of the judge is similar to what's going on there. And so obviously God's not going to be talking much to a very, very sinful people.
Very good. Yeah, and in our study we mentioned this verse in Jeremiah. God says to Jeremiah, hundreds and hundreds of years later, go to my place which was in Shiloh, where I set my name at the first, and see what I did to it because of the wickedness of my people Israel. And then God goes on to say he'll do the same thing to Jerusalem that he did to Shiloh because of the wickedness of the people of Israel. So terrible. It's no surprise that God isn't speaking to people much because very wicked things are going on. Other comments on, yes, Dennis.
I looked at that, the first part, A, was the wife said the way the minister to the child. I kind of saw it as the two key words there in verse 1 is before Eli. Kind of looked that up, and it kind of means what I found the way in front of. And so I thought it was kind of saying that Samuel was like a priest of training, an apprentice, so to speak, in order to learn to be a priest, there wouldn't necessarily be involved some degree of ministering, maybe not in full capacity, but, you know, training, you're here, I'm not just doing the whole thing on myself, so
right.
It's kind of nice.
That's good. True. And, you know, Eli wasn't sin-free either, obviously. Kind of the way we talked about it was Samuel is probably the only, priest in, Levite in the area who's not engaged in, obviously we're kind of painting with a broad brush, but everybody knew about what Hophni and Phinehas were doing, and we're not told the others weren't doing it too. And so in a way, Samuel is sort of an exception to the rule, the general depravity, perhaps. I mean, if you were a priest at that time and you knew what Hophni and Phinehas were doing, obviously you'd want to call them out, and like we do in the church. We have the same responsibility in the church, right? We, 1 Corinthians chapter 5, we have to disfellowship a sinful brother in Christ. And so, but I agree, he ministered before Eli was his mentor. And I certainly think that's true. Other comments on this section? Yes, brother.
I was really excited. I got me a James E. Smith commentary. And I thought, I'm probably mentioning his name several times tonight because I thought he did really good on this chapter, but he actually said something very similar to what Dennis just said, that he was kind of in training. He mentioned maybe a personal assistant, because we do get a description of Eli. Poor Eli. He was old. He was he had dim eyes. Yeah, he wasn't the most fit person. So personal assistant or working before him. I think that's really good. The other thing he mentioned was as far as the word of the Lord being rare or infrequent in those days, it shows this chapter is highlighting when the word of the Lord finally does come, the first time that it comes to Samuel, and how big of a deal that must have been. Because I think that's hard for us to really fathom, because we just have the word of the Lord and we're just reading the word of the Lord. When all this is taking place. So the absence of that and how long that might have been, it could have been years, decades, who knows. And then for it to finally come, kind of this rise of hope, back in the land, chapter 3 is a big deal.
Yeah, it's a new era with Samuel. Samuel brings the new era. But of course, we do know that back in chapter 2, there was a prophet of God who received a revelation. So I don't think it's saying that there was no word. I think it's just saying that Samuel's inaugurating a new era. Samuel's going to be the direct conduit to God. And in a way, it kind of goes, I think it was Landon that said last time, it says that in chapter 2 that Samuel grew in knowledge and reputation among the people. I forget what the verse is, but it compares to what's the verse that speaks about Jesus, and Luke says the same thing. Jesus grew in
wisdom and stature.
Wisdom and stature. It says the same thing. So the idea is that
Samuel brings a direct connection and enforcement of God's laws to the people. God's law is not being enforced. There are all these terrible things going on. And Samuel, in a way, is the hammer of the Lord. And so I think, to me, that's what it's on. Other thoughts? All right. We will go to Cole next then. What does it mean the lamp of the Lord hadn't gone out yet? What does this account reveal about how it is when the Lord talks to a prophet?
So the lamp of the Lord refers to the lampstand tabernacle. We more commonly know that as the menorah. So the way it was supposed to work is that it was supposed to be lit in the evening and to stay lit until the morning. So the lamp of the Lord not going out yet means that this was sometime between the late evening and the early morning. So this would likely have been before dawn. So maybe Eli was sleeping in the tabernacle attending to the lampstand. And this account shows that the Lord can talk to prophets directly, very verbally. Because with a lot of pagan traditions, it's you'll have some sort of dream or some sort of vision. But here we have Lord speaking coherent sentences, things of that sort.
Very good. As it did with Moses. Mm-hmm. Right. Very good. Yeah, my thoughts on this, and we commented on this in our study, it speaks to Samuel's zeal as a young man for the Lord, because here he is surrounded by all of this wickedness. And he had to have been enticed by the other priests to engage in this wickedness. Help us steal the best parts of the offering. We can do that. The people don't care. We can take the best parts of the offering. Why should we just take what the Lord gives us? Or what about the ladies? Don't you want to be part of that? And so Samuel has been enticed, and yet the Lord hasn't spoken to him until now. Samuel has stayed strong in the midst of wickedness. So it's sort of a Joseph-like image. Joseph resisted sin even though all his brothers were wicked. And then he went to Egypt, and there was wickedness all about him in Egypt, and yet he resisted, and he was faithful to God. And so Samuel is also faithful to God, and even though it's a terrible time in Israel. All right, any other thoughts? Okay. Question number three as Cole pointed out, here is a map of, or a diagram of the tabernacle. And here is the lampstand inside that was lit from the sun going down till the sun coming up. And the idea is that apparently Samuel is within this area of the tabernacle, because it later says that he opened the doors of the tabernacle. So when he thinks he hears Eli speaking, he's leaving this area and perhaps going outside of the courtyard. Although somebody might disagree with that, but most of the commentators seem to think that is what is happening. And here is, I think, the altar of incense should be a little bit closer to the curtains, but otherwise, here's the lampstand on one side, the table of showbread, and the altar of incense in the holy place, and there is the most holy place with the ark. Okay, for Austin, what does it mean the Lord came and stood? What was the prophecy the Lord gave Samuel? Why was this prophecy given to Eli a second time?
Okay, so what does it mean the Lord came and stood? I think this is talking about the fact that there was something of a presence. I think whether that was in bodily form, which it very well may have been, probably was. This could be another Christophany, an angel of the Lord type of scenario. But whatever it was literal. It wasn't just something going on in Samuel's head. And I think the end of the chapter reaffirms that the Lord came back to Shiloh, or something of that nature. I forget exactly how it phrases it. But I think that's what's going on there. The prophecy that the Lord gives to Samuel here is a reaffirmation of what we read in chapter 2 that the man of God told Eli directly face to face, with a little added thing here. Verse 14 there talks about how the iniquity of Eli's house shall not be atoned for by sacrifice or offering forever. So you fill in the blanks maybe a little bit. You would think Eli gets this prophecy spoken against him, and probably his immediate reaction is to start offering sacrifices. Or maybe Hophni and Phinehas, you know, they're not dumb. They are priests, even though they have sinned with a high hand, as the Bible talks about. They know that you're supposed to offer sacrifices for sins, because that was their job. They did that on a daily basis, presumably. And the Lord's telling them that's not going to cut it. The sin has already been done. You're not sorry for it. And basically for Eli, it's a too little, too late type of scenario. The judgment has already been set. Why was this prophecy given a second time? I got to thinking about this, and I actually got a new appreciation for Eli that I think we'll maybe talk about and uncover here in the next couple of questions. Why was it given a second time? Eli already knew what was going to happen, so why did God give it a second time to Samuel? My thought is that it wasn't so much against Eli as it was for the benefit of Samuel. So your very first prophecy that you're given is to who? The guy, presumably, the guy that's calling you my son. The guy that has basically raised you for several years now, that you're with every single day. And the Lord gives him a prophecy condemning him and saying his house is going to be forever destroyed. Now, if that's your mentor and you're a young man, you know, 12, 13, early teenage years, do you want your mentor hearing that for the very first time? Or do you want that to be an older message that he already knows? And so I think giving it the second time, it alleviates that shock value, that shock factor that Eli may have had. And instead, he tells Samuel, he urges him to go ahead and speak whatever this message is, to not hide it. Because for him as a prophet moving forward, he's going to have to give some very hard things to people. To people that he loves and people that he has a lot of respect for. And he can't be afraid. He can't hide that just because he deeply respects this person. So I think it's given a second time for Samuel's benefit. And Eli he teaches him a very valuable lesson in this moment. He teaches him a valuable lesson in verse 9. He gives him a saying to say back. He recognizes that the Lord is trying to communicate with Samuel. And James Smith says this, the response expresses eagerness when he says to speak, acknowledgement when he says speak Lord, humility when he says your servant, and attentiveness, your servant is listening, which are appropriate for one to whom God is speaking. So Eli, in this moment in time, he's messed up a lot of times before. And he's allowed his sons to do things that they shouldn't have done. But I think in this moment in time, he's training Samuel to be the prophet that he would ultimately be. That's my take. I know that may be a hot take, but that's what I got.
Other thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. We actually discussed how you get a little better feeling for Eli in this chapter than the previous. Of course, can't miss the fact that he's giving advice that he doesn't take himself. He did not listen to the Lord speaking. So, but I do agree that it's mainly for the benefit of Samuel, because Samuel is, this would become known, obviously, among everyone that Samuel had spoken this prophecy, and then he was willing to speak this prophecy to his mentor. And later in life, your point, later in life, Saul, you know, Samuel loved Saul, and it wounded his heart when the Lord told him that I'm going to remove Saul from the kingship. And Samuel had to go to Saul in the same way he had to go to Eli and tell and give Saul the bad news. King Saul of bad news that you and your family will no longer reign. over in the nation of Israel. So that's a very good point. As far as the standing, you know, I look back at a couple verses to remind myself of how often this happens. It happens in Genesis 3, verse 8. Adam and Eve heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. In Exodus 34, verse 5, it says, "The Lord descended in a cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of the Lord." So the Lord descended, stood, and then proclaimed the name of the Lord. Now that is something to try and wrap your mind around right there. How about Numbers 12? "The Lord said to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, come out, you three, to the tabernacle of meeting. So the three came out. Then the Lord came down in the pillar of cloud and stood in the door of the tabernacle." So this is not the only time the Lord stands in the tabernacle. It's his tabernacle. And as you say, I think it's probably a Christophany. The fact that the Lord descends and then proclaims the name of the Lord, that sounds to me like God the Son proclaiming the name of God the Father. But obviously, up for debate. That's sort of a March study sort of debate. Let's see. Ears tingling. I thought that was an interesting part of this. I thought about when something has been shocking. And, you know, there are variably shocking things that happen in life that you hear about. But I thought of 9/11. Obviously there's terrible things that we hear, but 9/11 is one of those things that if you're old enough to remember, you remember what that was like to hear about what had happened in New York City. And why is the prophecy given twice? Another reason, aside from establishing Samuel, is to reiterate its finality and surety, to cement Samuel as a prophet and judge. It's what happened. And I guess the slide I was thinking about after this, so we'll go ahead and move on. All right. Any other comments on question number 3 before we move? Okay. Hunter, if you want it, question number 4. Why was Samuel afraid to tell Eli his vision? What was Eli's response? We've kind of covered this a little bit.
But. No, I was going to say, you pretty much answered it for me. Or at least Austin did. So, as Austin said, I mean, I would imagine Samuel would have preferred to tell Eli because this was a mentor figure for him. You know, you think if you had some mentor or boss or whoever, someone you look up to at work again and say, "Hey, sorry, this really bad thing's going to happen to you, and there's not a whole lot you can do about it," that probably would be a very comfortable thing to tell. It's interesting. I mean, there seems to be no real imperative here, at least by God, for Samuel to tell Eli this. And so, kind of like you're talking about, Eli kind of tests him and comes in, and Samuel does the, as Austin said, does the just thing of saying this very uncomfortable thing. It's kind of a litmus test of stuff he's going to have to do in the future, and any prophet would have to do. And of course, there's an implication for us there as well. Austin was talking about that couple here on Sunday. They came and visited. They said that they appreciated the fact that we talked about things that were kind of uncomfortable to talk about. And so that's our job as well as Christians, for sure. And then what was Eli's response? He takes it very well. Does the Lord let him do what seems good to him? Interesting, you don't know when he received this prophecy the first time. But however many years back, it's interesting if he took it that way as well back then, that his sons did all this stuff for probably years and years and just said, finality of the Lord. And instead of trying to actually change it and actually, maybe change the Lord's mind and not have this really harsh judgment cast upon him and his family. But he drinks and bears it. That's about it.
That's interesting. You made me think a little bit about how he might have interpreted the unnamed prophet of God back in chapter 2 that comes and gives this prophecy to him. Maybe it was somebody he'd never met before, didn't even know, and then he comes wandering up out of the desert and says,
"This will befall you."
You know, and then, "Who are you?" And you have to know in Israel, because we know this was the case later, post-temple time, or even during the prophet's time. People were making up stuff all the time. There were wannabe prophets wandering around Israel. They're copycats, right? That's what people do. It's the JWs. It's the Mormons. It's the, you know, Seventh-day Adventists. They're copycats everywhere that want to be prophets of the Lord. And so maybe Eli had to deal with two or three copycats a week that came and said,
because of your sons, blah, blah, blah.
But now, Samuel. So here's this young man who he's trained and hears a voice three times and then doesn't want to tell him. And then he says the same thing with the unnamed prophet. So I looked at it that way. That's a good talking. That would bring it home to Eli that for sure this is going to come to pass. All right. Dennis, let's see. I might have that slide might be hiding out here. Yes, there it is. So what does this mean that Eli's house is going to be destroyed? So Nadab and Abihu were, there were four sons of Aaron. Nadab and Abihu, of course, gave fire that was inappropriate to the Lord and were killed back at the beginning in the institution of the priesthood. And then the two other sons of Aaron are Eleazar and Ithamar. And the descendants of Ithamar include Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, and I'm sure there were other people in between there, Hophni and Phinehas, and then these individuals. Ichabod is born at the end of chapter 4, I think. It means the glory has departed Israel. And this guy shows up over here. But all of these people, except for Abathar, were killed when Saul, King Saul, in 1 Samuel 22, went to where the tabernacle was at Nob and said, he turned to his guards and said, kill the priests of the Lord, because their hand is with David. They were supporting David. And because they knew when he fled and he did not tell him any. The servants of the king would not lift their hands to strike the priests of the Lord. The king turned to Doeg. You turn and kill the priests. So Doeg the Edomite turned and struck the priests and killed on that day 85 men who wore the linen ephod. So this is the ear-tingling part. Saul killed the priests, 85 at this location. And this one survived. He's probably a baby at the time. And later, under Solomon, he was removed. This is 1 Kings 2:27. He was removed from being priest to the Lord that he might fulfill the word of the Lord which he spoke concerning the house of Eli at Shiloh. So it's a complicated prophecy, and it kind of goes on through time. But the Lord kept his promise finality. Yes, brother.
On Eli's response, I got to thinking about that a little bit too. There's a couple different ways you can kind of read his response. You can kind of read it in a flippant voice. Well, it is the Lord. He can do whatever seems good to him, I guess. But I'm not sure that's exactly what he says. I think it's a much more tearful, sincere response. Because I think Eli does care. Most of his sin is involved in inaction, I feel like. He knows what is going on. And he just doesn't do anything about it or gives a weak sauce response. You guys really shouldn't be doing all this. You need to stop. Which is too little too late, even though he's known it for a long time. So I think he genuinely meant what he said, that he recognizes that the Lord is sovereign and that what he has determined is the right and just thing, and he's not arguing against it. And what came to my mind was, how many of us have the faith that Eli has, where we are okay with the Lord? We can put our faith in God even if he were to condemn us. Because that's what he does here. The Lord told him twice, your house is going to be condemned. And your house is going to be cut off because of the sins that you've committed. And he says, okay, if that's what the Lord wants to happen, then that's what's going to happen. And I think that's a pretty powerful example.
Yeah, I agree that it's definitely admirable in a sense, but of course he should have raised himself up off of his couch or seat at that point and said, if that's the Lord's decision, then I will help him take care of it. And then he should have gone out and struck down his family. Maybe ask Samuel to help him.
or hired some other thugs. But, you know, I mean, that would have been the correct response instead of just acquiescing. But I see your point. I mean, but of course, inaction in the Lord's house is a terrible sin as well. And we can be guilty of it by seeing sin and not wanting to step out of it, especially when it comes to family. Right? Oh, yeah. That's the big risk. So. Other thoughts and comments? Yes, Logan.
Just to add on to the Eli discussion, I agree with all the criticisms that have been made about him, but, you know, God is trusting him to raise up Samuel, right, to be a good mentor to him. And if he was a total recluse, you know, just a waste of a priest, I don't think God would have allowed, you know, Samuel needs to be prepared for this. So, you know, as he might fail in some regards, he's taking an active role in Samuel's development. So I think that's worth considering.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think he's a pitiable. He's admirable in some ways, but he's very pitiable as well in that he didn't take a strong stand for the Lord. But obviously, he's probably the one that did, as you're saying, he probably protected Samuel from his own sons. I would imagine maybe he went to his own sons and said, leave Samuel alone, maybe. Or maybe it was Samuel's inner character all by himself. It's hard to know. We're just not told. Other thoughts? All right, Lance, I guess you get the last question. What does it mean that the Lord let none of his words fall to the ground? What does it mean that Samuel was established from Dan to Beersheba? Oh, did I skip? Yeah, sorry. All yours, Dennis.
What does it mean that the Lord let none of his words, small a, see if that's referencing Samuel's words. Samuel was growing into a role position and becoming a well-respected prophet of the Lord. This phrase, none of his words fall to the ground, I took that to mean to indicate that he, the Lord, would be making good on all of his promises through Samuel's prophecies or predictions. In other words, they would fall to the ground and that probably meaning become useless or not come to pass. Pass on it. Second part of that, what does it mean that Samuel established from Dan to Beersheba? This phrase, from Dan to Beersheba, was often used to describe the border of the promised land, Dan being the northern city and Beersheba, the southernmost city. So everyone in Israel knew that Samuel was a legitimate prophet of the Lord. The last part of what does verse 21 mean that the Lord appeared again in Shiloh. The Lord revealed himself to Samuel in Shiloh by the word of the Lord. Tell you what I have, and probably not right, even talking about this. The Lord is once again communicating with Israel, evidenced by the fact that he had Samuel. But I keep up with
it. Very good. Yeah, it's interesting how it says that several times that it is the word of the Lord that appears to Samuel, and said that earlier. And of course, we know John, when he wrote his gospel, said in the beginning was the word, and the word was with God. And so in a way, it kind of sounds like, you know, we're talking about God the Son, you know, appearing to Samuel and giving him guidance. And I mean, what a phenomenal way for things to change in Israel, right? You, prior to this, every man did what was right in his own eyes. Even your prophet, you know, Samson, has many, many issues. So, you know, terrible things are happening. People are free to do whatever they want. Even Gideon is, you know, flawed. We went through the list of judges. But now there's Samson. And Samson's going to show up. There's a deviation from God's law. Or Samuel's going to show up. Maybe Samson. Samuel's going to show up if there's a deviation from God's law. And we notice later, he kills Agag. We talked about that in our study. Saul did not kill Agag as he was supposed to by the word of the Lord. And Samuel shows up, apparently armed. And Agag says something along the lines of, surely the time of death has passed. And Samuel hacks him to death before the Lord. So this is a man who meant business, and he was extremely sincere and pure and driven to do the will of the Lord. So quite a hero. I must say I have a new appreciation for Samuel after studying the last few chapters.
Okay.